This week on RSBNB Update, a long-awaited dual update week featuring both a quest in Curse of the Blackstone and the final in the Elite Dungeon Trilogy, the Shadow Reef. We run through the quest and talk about the bosses and mechanics of the Shadow Reef. This is RSBNB Update, episode 713, recorded Thursday, February 28th, 2019. Surprises of the Shadow Reef. Hello, everybody, and thank you for joining us once again for another episode of RSBNB Update. We're back this week to discuss what I think will be remembered as one of the most monumental update weeks in RuneScape history, at least in recent RuneScape history, I think. Tanis, you're here.
Yep, I am.
As per usual, a bit of an off week for you, given the nature of the update. But we'll get to that.
A little bit of a third wheel, but you know, we'll keep on turning. Kind of the chaperone, you know, that goes along on the date. You know, this is fortunate.
Yeah, but of course, joining us also is David, our resident PVM expert, Cabru in game. To discuss Elite Dungeon 3, the Shadow Reef. You know, we've made a trio of this so far: Elite Dungeon 1, Elite Dungeon 2, and now Elite Dungeon 3, of course. And before that, Solak. I know you've been having a good deal of fun with the Ambassador, so we'll definitely get to that. So just to get us started, I mean, give us a quick little brief rundown, the 30-second thoughts of what you've seen this week combat-wise.
Yeah, I mean, I think Ambassador is my favorite boss to be released since Solak. I'd have to think about it, but I think it's probably in my top five favorites, at least in terms of solo. And I think that there are some balancing concerns I have in terms of the reward side direction, but in terms of the mechanics and fun direction, I am a huge fan of this content.
And, you know, this would have been a huge week regardless, as with all the other Elite Dungeons, but, you know, there was something else. There was something else with this, something that hasn't happened in a long time. And I had to go back in my notes and the show notes to look at this. And what happened this week hasn't happened. And, you know, you could say that this might even be an asterisk on this, but this hasn't happened since episode 568 back in May of 2016. Where we've had effectively two headlining updates be released in 1 week. And in case you're wondering, what do you mean two headlining updates? Of course, we have Elite Dungeon 3, the Shadow Reef, but we also have a invisible quest that wasn't mentioned in the news post, Curse of the Blackstone. And you know, we love quests, and you know, it was only 2 weeks ago we had Quest Week with Chef's Assistant, the Cheesecake Quest, and lo and behold, here we are 2 weeks later doing another Quest Week. I would never have thought that we would have done that, but here we are. Curse of the Blackstone. This is a master level quest. Doesn't really have too many requirements on it, and I think we can say that both of these are headlining updates, right? Both ED3 and Curse of the Blackstone.
Yeah, totally. I wish there was a quest every 2 weeks, 52 weeks a year.
You're preaching to the choir.
After high-level PVM, questing is the second best thing, at least to me, obviously, my perspective.
Well, I might have a place for you to reside then. We'll have to wait and see on that. But in any case, so Curse of the Blackstone, what we're going to do with this week's update is we're going to discuss that first, Curse of the Blackstone, and then we're going to move on to Elite Dungeon 3, because the way this quest works is that it ties directly in with Elite Dungeon 3 and actually the two other Elite Dungeons as well. So what we're going to do here is we're going to do our typical Quest Week coverage of Curse of the Blackstone, and then we're going to move into Elite Dungeon 3 and talk about the boss mechanics that are there and some of the drops and some of the ramifications from this. So what we're going to do is I want to go over the first, of course, the core requirements of this, in particular that this is a master level quest. We're looking at 12 agility and 34 woodcutting, rather, which isn't steep. You also need to have done Impressing the Locals, which, of course, is the quest that opens up the Ark, So take that for what it's worth as well. They also recommend that you complete Sliske's Endgame, Pieces of Hate, and that it is indeed a six-age quest. So you're going to want to have some of the lore tidbits to get the full impact of what we got here with this. David, I know you did the quest. Tanis, you're kind of off to the sidelines with this one because of the Elite Dungeon, but that's okay.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start by going over this, and David, Tanis, you guys feel free to jump in and stop me whenever you want to talk in particular about the quest here, because this quest is certainly an interesting one, and I found it interesting because it's actually being used as a narrative device to tie multiple pieces of content together, and in some ways breaks the fourth wall rather hilariously, I found, though not as bad as some things like the Gower quest. So this quest, you start off by talking with Beryl Foxdaughter at Daemonheim. And, you know, you might have realized that this quest existed if you logged in and you saw your quest point cape was gone and you were missing the four quest points that are rewarded from this quest. Spoilers, of course, going forward on that. And, you know, in talking with Beryl Foxdaughter, she does say that she does have a quest for you, and you need to figure out what's happening with the Blackstone and how it is, or how the sinister force is attempting to summon an ancient evil to Gielinor, which we'll talk about after Elite Dungeon 3 in the conclusion of this. And the first step of this is that you need to find what she calls the Jade Spider, and you're of course pointed to the arc for this, and you start off on the main arc island, which is Wyco, and you basically question all the shop makers there, and through that you learn that you need to then move your adventure to Whale's Maw, which is another one of the Ark Islands. And, you know, this is where one of the funniest parts of this quest happened for me. You have to dig in the sand to try and find this ancient artifact. And when you're digging in the sand, your player actually starts cursing all the different gods, which isn't something you normally have in RuneScape, because as we do it in real life, that would be inappropriate to say on the show. But, you know, you can utter Bandos and Armadil's name as much as you want in this quest and not have much of a problem with it. So that was good fun, I thought.
I thought so too. They're getting really good at that sort of thing, just adding in dialogue that makes stuff fun and engaging.
Yeah,
and feels more realistic and mature versus quests from like 5 years ago.
And what we really like about these quests is that, you know, they're just so deep, because you didn't need to go through all this dialogue if you didn't have to. And this is why I encourage everybody who's doing a quest to go through as much of the dialogue as you can, because you just get these little odd tidbits like that. Another thing that your player notices is that Zamorak's wings were upside down and weren't aerodynamic enough that he couldn't take flight with them.
I mean, it's not wrong.
Yeah, and you know, that of course is something that you don't need to put into RuneScape quest, but it's just there, and I definitely appreciated that. Following that, your journey takes you to Twilight, where you talk to one of the sea singers there in the central area by the bank, and then she points you over to Goshima. And of course, Goshima is the gray island that had the big door on it. And when the Ark came out, I said, you know, I would love one day to go into whatever is behind that door on Goshima and see what's there. And I hope we don't need to wait another decade for that. Well, what happens on Goshima is that if you kill the 12 Crassians that are on the island, the gates of Goshima will actually open up, and you'll get to see what's actually happening behind them. And I was actually very pleased about this, because when you start off this quest, you don't necessarily know that it's going to send you all the way to the Ark, right? But after exploring through the Ark, you get this little nugget that, okay, we can finally go into the gates of Goshima, and you actually make some interesting discoveries in there, so much so that you find Madame Shi, who we last saw in Pieces of Hate, and she tells you that she is indeed the Jade Spider that everybody has been looking for. So, so far, what we have here in the quest is just a bunch of running around, talking with various NPCs and a bit of dialogue. And the actual meat of the matter is about to begin on this quest, because what happens when you talk with Madame Shi is that she talks about being called by the ambassador that is in service to something dark and terrible. And this ultimately led to a new religious order being established on the island of Amanishi, and in particular inside the temple of Amanishi. You guys see where we're going with this, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And, you know, this quest was just building onto this. And I really like the first half of the quest a lot. And we'll get to why that changes later.
I just want to say I'm in firm agreement. The first half to first two thirds were like 10 out of 10. Kind of everything felt perfect and just right and exactly what I wanted.
Yeah. And I think we'll have some discussion why after the fact that changes. So anyway, she talks about the ambassador, of course, and this horrible being that wants to destroy Gielinor and is dark. And, you know, we saw rumblings of this and pieces of hate with all the various cats and the hands falling and whatnot. And this is in some ways tangentially a continuation of pieces of hate. So I would say at this point, if you guys have not done Pieces of Hate and you're listening to this and you want to do this quest, I would say 100% take the time, go do Pieces of Hate, because Pieces of Hate on its own is a great quest, but your lore and what you're learning from this quest is just going to be completely amplified by doing Pieces of Hate. So anyways, continuing on, she says that she covertly joined the order and joined their ruling council eventually. That's how high up she was able to get. And she then realized that they were dealing with Blackstone. And she also mentions that she's very good at warding magic. And I actually just want to take a moment here to mention that term, warding magic. Does that sound familiar to anyone?
Oh, it sounds like something that came up at RuneFest, right?
Yeah, for old school RuneScape.
Yeah.
So there are references, of course, now to warding in RuneScape 3. So I'm not saying we need that as a skill. I'm just saying it might be a nice addition to see at some point to make some magic armor and rebalance the crafting table. So okay. So she mentioned she's good at it, and the reason she wanted to mention she was good at it is because the magical defenses that were in place at the Temple of Amanishi, she set it up so that they could be penetrated by someone like the World Guardian. And the logic in this is that when you are when you're in the Temple of Amanishi and you kill the various mobs and what do we call them? Trash mobs? Mini bosses? I don't know. What do you call the ones that we need to take, David, to just move on through the various
trash mobs.
Yeah. So at that point, she says that this is suited towards the World Guardian, and this is the point in which the quest you need to play Elite Dungeon 1, the Temple of Amanishi. So this is why you need to have this completed for this quest. And you can do it in story mode, which is a 90% reduction in damage that the NPCs do, and a 50% reduction on their health. So it's much more survivable, except you're just doing it to get the checkbox that, hey, I completed this, and you can pick some lore books up along the way. And then, you know, you talk to her, and she mentions that, you know, what you did with Siryu, and this is pretty much a summary of the lore of Elite Dungeon 1 at this point, and that you, the player, discovered Siryu being held there and freed him from the corrupting Blackstone. And with that, it's time to move on, that we need to move to a different area of this, and there's might be more stuff happening. And this was alluded to in the lore of Temple of Amanishi, that Madame Shi is very upset that the Order was able to take someone that was corrupted, like Siryu, effectively a corrupted sacred anima guardian. And, you know, when you were ultimately investigating what was happening here with this, you wind up discovering that, you know, there's actually something going on here about Dragonkin. So that is what her agents uncovered while you were off doing the Elite Dungeon, so to speak. So there was something happening while you were in the Elite Dungeon. And, you know, who knows the most about Dragonkin in game? Well, The answer to that is, of course, Mr. Mardot in the Varrock Museum. And we talked to him in One of a Kind, and he believes that the tablet that was found by Madame Xi's archaeologists, or the people who are working while we were in Elite Dungeon 1, is a map of some sort. And she talks about the font of creation in the cold northeast. And you talked to Mr. Mardot about this, and this is an effective pointer to Daemonheim. And, you know, we've done this before in regards to Karapak and whatnot in One of a Kind. So you head over to Daemonheim. And right immediately to the south of where you teleport, there's a fountain that's been there for a long time. And you'll see that for this quest, it's missing one of its eyes. So you need to repair its eye. And in order to repair its eye, you use a modified chip Dragonstone. And then once you place that in, it unlocks this ornate tower, crumbling watchtower, that you're able to climb down. And that leads us down to Karapak's lab in below Daemonheim. It looks very much like Dungeoneering, as it is below Daemonheim. And down there, we find Hanibus, who we also last saw in One of a Kind. So you can kind of see the echoes that we're feeling with this one. And I don't know about you, David, but did you get the sense when we were doing an Elite Dungeon 1 that there was a Dragonkin link to anything?
I mean, it felt like it a little bit, right? I mean, yeah. Two, definitely.
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember specifically what felt dragonkin-ish. I guess I'm like the general layout and design
and the,
of things.
And the creatures, they were basically sea dragons.
Yeah.
So in Karapak's lab, we talked to Hanibus, and he ultimately suggests that the next place we should look to deciphering the rest of this map is the dungeon in which metal dragons are made. And, you know, if going back to One of a Kind on this, this does refer us to the lore of the Adamant Dragons, which is the Adamant Dragon dungeon, which is accessible from within the Brimhaven dungeon. And I remember when this came out, we were looking at this at the lore here, and we saw there were murals on the wall, and there were artifacts and whatnot placed there. And, you know, these artifacts along the wall, various heads of different dragons, bronze, iron, steel, mithril, and adamant. If you look at any of them when they were there before, they were just ornate on the wall. But these actually turn out to be the smelters that are able to use to create the metal dragons. And the whole reason that we're here is we're looking for another piece, or a piece that we can modify in order to make the map a little bit more readable. So in searching through this place, we find a piece of metal that we can ultimately use to fix the cipher. We discover that the metal dragons, are ordinarily calm and intelligent, but the ones that we fight are deeply tormented and are enraged. And Hanibus, as a dragon rider, is able to interact with them and provide a voice to the dragons, enabling them to speak. And, you know, you find one of them down here, one of the few remaining ones that is not dead, because they're made dead for the quest, obviously, so it's a safe area to be in. And when you talk to this adamant dragon, she says that all of her children have been taken and killed, whereas the eggs that are remaining are her grandchildren. And as any grandparent would be, there she is very, very upset about this. And it's just a nice little bit of Dragonkin lore that we weren't expecting to get in this quest. So further on, we take this piece of metal, have this dragon heat it up, and then we dip it in a well to make it more brittle. And then after that, we're able to use it to make the cipher more readable so that Hanibus can translate it. And the cipher says that, lo and behold, we must return back to Karapak's lab. And I don't know. At this point, did you find, David, the back and forth on this a little bit annoying?
Not yet. This isn't quite where I got annoyed. This part, I was still excited. Part of that might just be because I am particularly into the Dragonkin stuff.
Okay.
But yeah, there is a point where I get just really frustrated. But at this point, I was still very much into it as an adventure.
Okay.
Did not quite get that feeling.
All right. So we head back to Carapax's lab, and there's a circular pattern on one of the doors. And what you need to do is you need to investigate a bunch of the effigy shells and activate the five dragonkin statues in the correct order to activate this portal. And then upon activating them correctly, you enter into a portal that takes you to where the ruined dragons exist on Kethsi. And we have the pleasure of witnessing Carapax talking to the other dragonkin in a cutscene in which he is detailing the curse that has been lifted. And this is where Sliske's endgame comes in. Because recall that the Stone of Jazz, formed by the Elder God Jazz, was keeping the Dragonkin in line, and the Dragonkin were cursed and bound to defend that stone. The Dragonkin got incredibly mad if anyone used the Stone of Jazz incorrectly. And when the Stone of Jazz was destroyed at the end of Sliske's endgame, their curse was ultimately lifted. And they are saying that they are going to be taking steps to ensure that they will never, ever be enslaved again. And this is perhaps one of the most interesting points to me in this entire quest. We'll get to another very important one later, but this one is probably the second most important in this quest, in that Carapax notes that there will be a time in the future where the player is going to have to do something for him. He won't say what it is right now. He also knows what you're after in this case, in particular with Curse of the Blackstone, but he can't provide you any more information on it. So he says, okay, with this being said, maybe you should just go back to this old laboratory of mine. And he says that it's home to some of his greatest experiments and some of his greatest mistakes. And the player wants more information on this, but is ultimately turned down. So at this point, we know that we're going to be at some point in the future, and we know this was the case with the Elder Gods, and definitely now with the Dragonkin, that there's going to be a time when the story is going to resume, and we're going to need to work with Carapax to do something. But of course, the laboratory that he is talking about is the Dragonkin Laboratory, or Elite Dungeon 2. And it's at this point in the quest that you need to play Elite Dungeon 2 on story mode or regular mode if you haven't already been there. And I just want to take a moment at this point to mention that, you know, there's been a funny thing going on that happened with Elite Dungeon 1 and now Elite Dungeon 2 in this quest. Your player just tells both Madame Xi and then Brill Thought's daughter in this case that, oh, I've actually already been there and I've actually already moved through it.
Yeah, that's what I selected.
Yeah, because I mean, doing the quest, we didn't want to do it again. But I just found it interesting. Okay, we're in a narrative storyline that is a quest, but for some reason, the player, the world adventurer, might have already discovered stuff prior to what our protagonist in the quest did.
That's
so
okay. They're just particularly precocious.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right. Sense. Anyways, after playing Elite Dungeon 2, the Dragonkin Laboratory, you discover the Blackstone Dragon and relieve it of its curse. And then at this point, you gotta head back to, Goshima and talk with Madame Xi. And this is, I think, one of the most, amazing, narrative moments in the quest, because when you're here, you watch what happens in this cutscene, and the ambassador appears. Just as you're talking with Madame Xi, the colors invert, and then the ambassador kills everybody else inside this room, except for you and Madame Xi. And it's at this point, the gravity of the quest becomes clear, and what we're dealing with and what we're going to be dealing with in Elite Dungeon 3. Go ahead.
I heard the graphics for that were really impressive.
Oh, yeah. This was a great cutscene. If you're watching the YouTube version of the podcast, I do have a bit of the cutscene playing in the background right now, and you know, there's just a huge scale with the walls of Goshima. So and that's why I said this was perhaps the biggest narrative point of the quest, aside from the two lore nuggets that we talked about, first being Carapax, and the second one we'll get to in just a moment. But the ambassador is going to be a problem. That's what we learn. So much so that everybody inside this area has been killed except for you and Madame Shi. And then, you know, with the ambassador being there, that means that, hey, it's going to be time soon to play Elite Dungeon 3. But before that happens, the mini quest begin. And is this the point at which the quest started getting annoying for you?
Is this when we go to the Black Knight's Fortress and then...
Almost. So
okay, let me see. Where was it that... Okay, so what's about to happen now?
All right. So now we need to head over to the Hydromancer in Draenor Village to...
Oh, treat ourselves with a potion so we can breathe underwater. I was still into this because I figured that there needed to be a lore explanation for why we were able to fight underwater without a boat. I'm serious. I mean, it was like in the past, right? You always had to wear the diving suit. And if when you go do your monthly D&D for the Oyster, you can't have weapons equipped and you can't have a familiar. So, you know, I was thinking in terms of the lore, how are you supposed to fight an ambassador, someone who just killed 30 people or whatever in one hit without weapons or a familiar?
Exactly.
And so I felt like this was a necessary... Now, maybe this could have replaced a different task, but I felt like this was a must.
This was a huge lore impact for Elite Dungeon 3 on its own. So
So that's why I think this was good.
Yeah, and to make this potion, you need an empty vacuum vial, which you fill with air from the ice mountain, divine blinding light, you dry some seaweed at the Abbey in Alcarid, and any raw fish works, so I use shark, and this creates the potion of water breathing, which lets you breathe underwater. Then after this, you return to Hanabis. He wants you to recruit the King Black Dragon to help. You guys go talk to the King Black Dragon by using the artifact slightly to the west of Edgeville, and you select the Curse of the Blackstone option. The King Black Dragon obliges with that, and you ask the King Black Dragon, are there any other dragons that could help with this? And he says, I don't know, let's perhaps go back and talk to Mr. Mardeau if he knows anything. And he recommends talking to Vindicta. From God Wars Dungeon 2, who is also a dragon rider. And this is the biggest, I think, lore note in this quest, aside from the Carapac one and the narrative cutscene that we just saw, because there's this long discussion that goes on with you, Hanabis, and Vindicta in the heart. And through questioning and discussion, Vindicta, or rather Hanabis, starts to have a creeping suspicion that Vindicta just might be his daughter.
Yeah.
And it's confirmed.
Yeah.
What?
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah, this quest was just big reveal after big reveal in a lot of ways.
You know, and all of the stuff that you've talked about that ties in were all, like, favorites of mine in the past.
Oh yeah, this quest was amazing in terms of lore. I in terms of the lore reveals, it couldn't have been any better.
So yeah, that is perhaps the mind blown moment in this quest. And I asked around Clan Quest what the best moment was in this quest, or the most important part of this. And you know, aside from the obvious everything in the quest, that they said that this moment with Vindicta was. And I'm inclined to agree.
So yeah, I think that's right.
It sets up a nice triad between Hanabis, Vindicta, and ultimately Carapac for whenever we do need to confront the Dragonkin again. Now the mini quests begin. So that was the first one, or the first two, rather, and those ones made sense for the lore. But this next one is absolutely absurd.
Yeah.
Brill Foxdaughter wants you to mediate a lover's dispute between two seagulls. On Lyco.
Oh, right. This was terrible. It took me so long to find the seagulls. It took me more than 20 minutes to find them because
they're tiny little white dots that you need to click on the map.
Yeah, and because of my graphics setting, a lot of times I just like miss them. So it was just, this part was very annoying.
Tanis, I bet you'd enjoy this one.
This is the part that sounds like it'd be fun.
Yeah, this is where I stopped enjoying it.
Yeah. So there's the seagulls, and then the next one, the next mini quest resorts around Bosun Higgs, wanting you to recruit her elite forces from the Black Knight's fortress in the Taverly dungeon. Or sorry, the Black Knight's area in the Taverly dungeon. The Black Knight's fortress is, of course, something completely different there. I was reading from the next line down. And in order to do this, you need to talk with Lieutenant Crane down in the Taverly dungeon. But in order for this to happen, Lieutenant Crane wants you to check in on her sister, who is a cadet in training at the Black Knight's fortress. And so this begins the point where you got to run to the Taverly dungeon. Then you got to run back to the Black Knight's fortress. Then you got to run back to the Taverly dungeon and then back to the Black Knight's fortress again, finally. And this all culminates in discovering that her sister has been made a slave and the Black Knights have cut her tongue out. And after you report back to Lieutenant Crane for the final time, the decision is made to rescue her from the Black Knight's fortress. And what this effectively involves is picking up her piece of armor from the barracks and then going up to where she is as a slave. And then then you're able to just get out with her of the Black Knight's fortress and move on back to Daemonheim. And, you know, I think the problem I have with this quest is the seagulls and this part with the running back and forth.
Yeah. I mean, I was especially annoyed because at the very end of the running back and forth, you're just kind of teleported back to the Taverly dungeon where the Black Knights are. I don't know if you remember this.
Yeah.
But at the very end, you're just, so it's like, why couldn't, if you're gonna do this, like, why not just make this, like, make it so you're just teleported back and forth constantly or something? Because I don't know. I found it annoying. I mean, thank goodness for the dungeoneering, you know, cape to teleport you fairly close to the Black Knight's fortress, or I would really have been frustrated. But I basically found seagulls till the end just totally unnecessary. Because they could have easily just had Bosun Higgs say, by the way, I've recruited my fellow Black Knights, you know, promise them that you'll, I don't know, not turn them into Ceridoman or something. Whatever it is, who cares? Like, they could have easily just written that in with dialogue, and then the finale would have been the same.
The only reason I think, like, I personally think the seagulls should have been scrapped, and moving around to get to the Black Knight's area made a little bit easier narratively. But, of course, the thing that does happen lore-wise with the Black Knights on this is that the Commandant is killed.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I don't know. I just wish that – I think that could have been cut by a third, though. And
yeah,
you could
definitely
have still ended with the Commandant.
Definitely.
But you could have had – it could have easily been, I've heard my sister was made a slave. Let's go kill the Commandant.
Right. And then –
that would have been – I would have been totally satisfied, totally with it, and would not have been annoyed by it.
And then one run to the Taverly Black Knights area to recruit them to do that, and then – one to the Black Knight's fortress, kill the Commandant, and away we go.
Yeah, what was it, like four times you had to go back and forth or something?
Yeah,
one would have totally been fine.
Yeah, and I think the seagulls were just unnecessary. But I mean,
yeah, it's ridiculous.
I mean, this is a Mod Raven quest after all. Let us not forget that.
Yeah,
and he is renowned for putting silly things in like this. And when I say silly, I mean it in the kind of sense of the word.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the part where you have to dig for crabs sufficed.
Yeah,
that
was great.
but I think that was you didn't need to do more than that. That was sufficient.
Yeah,
I think. Look, in terms of silliness, just being put in for no reason.
So we bring her out and recruit her, and then everyone's back at Daemonheim, and then it's time to go on and take on. Take on Elite Dungeon 3, the Shadow Reef. So Commandant is dead. Some seagulls have been made whole again. Vindicta and Hannibus discover that they have a relation together. And, you know, lots of lore chalked into this quest here. So,
yeah.
And in some ways, you know, this quest acts as a follow-up to Pieces of Hate. It provides a bit of background to it. But it's not necessarily the full sequel to Pieces of Hate, which is good, I think. And that's to come after Elite Dungeon 3 is done. So I was overall very pleased with this quest. I had already fought Elite Dungeon 3 by the time I did the quest. I did Elite Dungeon 3 with you first, so
okay.
It was good. I enjoyed it.
I think for about 3/4 of it, it was very good for me. Maybe a little more than 2/3 of it.
Yeah, and I mean, it wasn't that the parts we were talking about was bad. It was just maybe we could have had this done in a slightly different way. So
yeah, exactly.
This quest rewarded 4 quest points, 3 huge XP lamps, and a 10% reduction of damage received permanently in all 3 elite dungeons.
Which is pretty big.
Yeah, I mean that's
10% a lot.
That is pretty good. So
yeah. Best quest reward in terms of stuff I'll use all the time that I can remember for a while, I think.
Yeah. Also 4 quest points, master level quest. And that of course signals that the lore tidbits that were provided here were plentiful and, let's just say, bountiful on this, because, you know, whenever you get the Dragonkin involved and you discover some huge curse that was happening, that is a master level quest, and that is indeed worth 4 quest points. So, you know, I have to give this quest a 3 out of 5. It's not a 4 out of 5, mainly because of just the way it was structured at the end. If they would have kept the full tempo that was going in about the first half to the first 2/3 of it, I think that could have brought it to a 4 out of 5 or maybe even a 5 out of 5, but I'm just going to go with the 3 out of 5 for this. So,
yeah, I'm going to cheat a little bit and give it a 4 out of 5 purely because I've found logging into the game and having a quest that was totally, completely unannounced, unleaked, etc., just like brought me back to nostalgia from 7 or 8 years ago, or however long it's been since that used to be a somewhat routine thing. It felt really good to log in and see a quest that I wasn't expecting.
You know, maybe I should change mine to a 4 out of 5 then as well. Because
you don't have to. I'm not trying to persuade you.
No, that is a very good point. I forgot about that. I forgot about that. That is big. Tanis, what do you think from what we've said on this?
Well, I'm kind of disappointed that I haven't and probably won't get to play it, just because I am such a sucker for the Dragonkin storyline. One of a kind with one of my favorite quests. I feel bad that I've been beating up a girl forever down there at God Worth 2. That's not nice. That's not very chivalrous, is it?
we've known Vindicta was a... We've known she was a girl for a long time.
Oh, had we? Okay, I must have missed it.
Yeah, we've known it for a long time.
It sounds like it's a... I really love all the ideas behind it. I mean, I love all the lore you explained. I don't know. It's hard because it's locked behind such a high level combat content, which is something I didn't think they were going to do going forward for questers.
But to be fair, we haven't tried Elite Dungeon 1 with you since they made the massive nerf to make it 90% reduction of damage.
Yeah, I think 90% reduction of damage functionally means you can ignore all mechanics and just eat through them. Plus, well, I like the health reduction. So I'm pretty sure
you guys should.
Think you could probably get through all 3 of them in story mode.
You guys should go together. Just if anything, story mode.
Yeah. I can take you. I'm pretty sure that we'll be totally fine in story mode.
That would be cool. I do have Trim Masterwork, so I can. I heard melee is the way to go, or someone told me that.
Melee is meta for trios. Magic is meta for solos.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah.
All right. Well,
as of now, it's been a week, so we'll see.
Let's talk now about Elite Dungeon 3, and you know,
we're gonna
address some of the lore stuff eventually later on. With this, but suffice to say, everything has been built up to thus far, and this is the final encounter with the ambassador. and we're going to slay him to prevent him from doing the bad. And we'll talk a bit about what could be next with this and how that can tie into future quests going forward after we talk about the ambassador. But let's begin, David, by talking about the various bosses that we have here. First up, the Cardassian Leviathan. So I'll let you do a combat rundown mechanic on that one for us.
So this boss is where most people die the most on their first turn. So like I died twice, but my team took 5 or 6 tries to get our first kill here. It's deceptively difficult because the punishment for making a mistake is pretty big. Basically, there's 3 different mechanics. Mechanic 1 is the room fills with poisonous mist or gas. I'm not really sure what it is. That both stuns and poisons and deals damage to you. And so you're forced into the far northern side of the room, which is where the boss is. Mechanic 2 is a copy and paste of the Queen Black Dragon's super hot dragon fire breath, the one that has kind of a cone shape that you have to be to the right or left of so you don't get annihilated.
That's one we use to heat the Royal Crossbow.
That's correct. And so if you are standing in front of it, it's very rapid. I want to say 5K hits, but it might be higher than that. I think it's rapid 5Ks and more. Yeah. So it's a 5K every tick, which, you know, Q can't out eat. And so, but it's very easy to avoid. You just stand to the right or stand to the left and it doesn't hit you at all. And then the third mechanic, which is the one most people struggle with, is it kind of moves its head from left to right and if you're standing on the ground that it causes an earthquake on, it looks like the earthquake ability sort of, you take rapid 4Ks, 4K per tick. That's the one that a lot of people have trouble with. Once you have done it, I would say 5 or 6 times and know what the animation looks like that indicates it's going to do that attack, it's extremely easy to avoid just by running in the opposite direction. You don't need to surge. You don't need to blade a dive. That's what everyone thought you had to, you couldn't kill the boss without mobile on release because you had to surge, blade a dive and have them on cooldown. Totally not true. I don't surge or blade a dive anymore. I keep attacking it with a scythe or with magic and I never stop attacking and I just like move from right to left. Assuming you avoid those 3 mechanics, it is very easy to do this boss with no food and no armor. There's no reason you need food or armor for this.
I think
because
it took
its other attacks don't hit you.
I think it took us, 3 or 4 tries to get it done.
Yeah. And on the 4th one, I just intercepted you. I just told you to stand in one place. Yeah. And I just intercepted you and I take all the damage.
My issue was, of course, the one that did the rapid 4Ks. I wasn't able to figure out which side it was going to come on and then move in a quick enough amount of time.
Yeah. And many of the best PVMers in the game died 4 or 5 times to the Leviathan on release because it is tricky to understand the timing of it, but again, once you know the timing, it's very easy. If you're taking a friend for the very first time, I would, and all they want is just one kill, they're not trying to learn the mechanics, just want one kill, I recommend having them stay either on the far right or the far left and telling them to use the reflect ability when the mechanic is about to happen, so then it'll be rapid 2Ks instead of 4Ks, and so it's much more survivable.
Yeah, and you know the reason I wasn't able to survive the 2Ks when we did that, I had Rocktails on my action bar instead of Bruise, which of course the Rocktails are tick locked, whereas the Bruise are not.
Yeah, so you want to be spamming Rocktail Brew.
Yeah.
Yeah, so you so, spam the Brew key while eating as many Rocktails
as
possible.
That was my problem with that.
Right.
And you know, after that, it was a relatively simple thing to do. And thank you for the intercepts on that one. And you know, we actually made it through the rest of the elite dungeon without any deaths after killing this first boss. So
yeah, we did. And that's the story. Very interestingly, that's the story for a lot of teams on their first few trio runs. Was they died a bunch to the first boss. And then didn't die at all to bosses 2 and 3. But bosses 2 and 3 are mechanically far more deep and complex. The first one is the simplest. There's just 3 things that it does, basically.
All right.
And then
One thing that I thought was awesome, one thing I love about this dungeon is how lore heavy it is. I don't know if you noticed, but the ambassador actually greets you when you get to the Craftsium Leviathan.
Yes, I did.
And like basically like taunts you, like he's just like talking smack the entire dungeon to you, which I think is hilarious. I kind of love this character because he's like clearly just, I guess we don't know their gender, but they're just clearly just absolutely just menacing beyond almost anything we've encountered. I mean, because most boss fights like Solak, Virago, Telos, you know, they're not evil, or, you know, Nex, none of them are they're either created to be like that or they're, you know, they're good in a sense, but have just been twisted in some way. But this person just seems like evil to the core. And I just think that that's kind of fun. And then I love the smack talking.
Yeah.
Too.
And that's the sense that we got with, what Madame Shi talked about when the ambassador appeared and killed everybody within Gashima too. So
right, yeah.
And keep in mind that chronologically, Elite Dungeon 3 is supposed to take place at the very end of Curse of the Blackstone. So
yeah,
that's the way that works. Anything about more about the Craftsium Leviathan?
No, I'd say that's it. The last thing I would say, just as a note, is I found the voice acting for this dungeon really fun. I did a few runs with the voice on, and the music. Thought the music was really good. I thought the voice acting was great. And so if you have a chance to, you know, do a run through the dungeon, either in story mode or in the normal mode, and just have a lot of people don't play with the music on or the voices on.
You definitely should.
It's worth it this time.
You definitely should.
Yeah.
So. All right.
No, that's about it. Yeah.
Okay. So next up comes Tereket the Necromancer, and this is boss number two. It seemed really simple for us to get from boss number one all the way to boss number two. There weren't really many insta-kill mechanics as we had in Elite Dungeon 1, like those ninja spinners and whatnot. So
yeah, there's really not. The only ones are... Yeah. The underwater horrors or whatever they're called. They're kind of like shadow horrors, but they're underwater or something. And they do a bleed since we don't have black masks on.
Oh, I believe. Okay. That's, so kind of like the cave horrors, but different.
Yeah, I intercepted you during that part. Okay. I didn't tell you, but yeah. Anytime we got to something that could be dangerous, after the Craftsium Leviathan, anytime we got to something be dangerous, I just intercepted you.
Okay. All right.
So, yeah, but that's fine. You know,
yeah, definitely.
I don't mind. That's why I bring interceptor runes. I found the layout really neat. Like the second, that room, the big giant room where you have to get an artifact on either side to unlock the gate in the middle. I found that they really did a great job of making the environment feel like you were interacting with the environment, which wasn't a thing for Elite Dungeon 1 or 2. It was just very linear.
And that's the typical, World of Warcraft kind of raid experience too. So,
yeah, which is, I think, what they're going for, if I understand it correctly.
Yeah, the Blackstone artifacts is what we had to interact with.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
And, Elite Dungeon 2 had the marker being really good for Slayer in that it had lava strike worms and dragons and whatnot down there. I don't see anybody using Elite Dungeon 3 for Slayer.
No. I mean, there's the three or four tormented demons, and those demons respawn, actually. I think they respawn. I'm not 100% sure. You'd have to test it. But there's three or four tormented demons. Other than that, there's really not much in terms of Slayer assignments.
All right. The Magister appears in this Elite Dungeon as a mini boss.
Yes, which I thought was super cool. Just like a lot of little lore things that were just really lovely.
And if you kill this, apparently, it drops Key to the Crossing, which you need to fight the actual Magister.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that's just a bit of a tidbit out there. All right, let's move on to boss number two.
Yeah, so Tereket is very straightforward. There's only one mechanic that has KO potential, and it only has real KO potential if you're in melee distance. And that's in trio. In solo, it's much more dangerous because you have a ton of mobs that are on you, and you have to choose between killing those mobs in order to make it safer or ignore them for DPS, which can really pile up the damage quickly. So I'm gonna be talking about this mostly in the context of trio, but just note that for bosses 2 and 3, solo is a very significant increase in challenge versus trio.
All right.
Yeah, so this boss basically alternates between magic attacks and ranged attacks, not back and forth, but just will be using magic, then will use the Death Swiftness ability, switch to range, then back to magic, etc. He spawns these portals that armies of the undead come out, very similar to the Sliske Halloween event portals. I think they reuse the same textures.
Yep. And that has been a hallmark of the Elite Dungeons, reusing assets from elsewhere in the game.
Which I like. I think that's fine. And if your team's DPS is good enough, this mechanic gets skipped entirely because it's time-based. But if your team's DPS isn't quite there, it's totally fine. Just make sure to kill those portals before the timer goes off or the boss gets a really massive heal.
Yeah, I actually saw that in reviewing some of our footage. It actually got one of those heals.
Yeah. So that'll happen. But it's really no big deal. You can just a heal. It doesn't really hurt too bad. It just increases the length of the fight. And then he spawns. Once you finish the first phase, after a minute, so 1 minute in, he gets an uber heal from this Blackstone Pillar. Is that what it's called?
Yes, I believe so.
Okay, yeah, so 1 minute in, no matter how much damage you dealt, although I suppose you could get him down to zero. I don't think that's happened yet. I'm not sure if it's possible. Maybe it is. I don't know. You get this uber heal, and he spawns a big giant zombie from the Dimension of the Damned.
The bloated monstrosity.
Right, bloated monstrosity, straight from Dimension of the Damned, and is unattackable while he's healing. Well, he's attackable, but all your targets hit one. So anytime he's flying, all damage is null. And so this is where it's really nice to use abilities like Natural Instinct to have adrenaline ready to do a lot of damage. If you're using magic abilities like Detonate, anything that charges is really nice here. And then phase two is very quick. You just do the exact same thing as phase one, essentially. And then he summons another big zombie thing.
The corpse carrier this time.
There you go, corpse carrier. And then after that, you just finish off the fight. And there's one mechanic at the end where he'll kind of raise up his arms and summon this wall of ghosts and do a really high dealing melee hit if melee distance. So if the ghosts run into you, or if you're in melee distance, you will take an extremely high hit, like 8 or 9K. And so the way to avoid this is just, if you're good with manipulating the tick system and you're in melee distance, I just escape bladed dive, same tick, which I'm very familiar with from Virago, in order to maximize DPS. If you're less familiar with the tick system and abusing it, then just surge away. You'll be fine. And then if you're not in melee distance, you just have to avoid the path of the ghosts, which is not terribly difficult. And then that's pretty much it.
Yeah, and then just to run to DPS down the boss, and this one I think was probably the most straightforward one.
It was pretty much entirely damage, because in a trio you could ignore all the mechanics completely and your risk of death is quite low.
Right. Okay. Which one would you say, would you say that the ghosts at the end are probably the most dangerous thing here if you're not careful?
Yeah, just because they could hit 8K, to 8K, which is hard, quite a lot of damage. And this is another example of just, I don't think we talked about this, but Trin Masterwork is absolutely phenomenal in this dungeon. This dungeon was made for Trin Masterwork. It's almost like they literally designed this content assuming people would be using that.
Yeah.
But because there are tons of mechanics that would kill you while you're berserked, right? Because you take way more damage when you're inside of a Zerk. But the Trim Masterwork nullifies that risk. And so it's much easier. Melee would be super dangerous here without Trim Masterwork. But because of Trim Masterwork, you can melee with a lot of confidence that you're not going to get one-shotted, because the Masterwork will cancel out the added dangers of using Berserk, which I really, really enjoyed. And then, of course, the fact that there's no charge drain is a really nice thing.
Right. Well, there we have it, folks. That's why you want your trim masterwork. We were hoping that when Mining and Smithing Rework came out, there'd be a reason for it. Well, here it is. So
yeah, other than small team hard mode Virago, which is super niche content, this is the best use of trim masterwork in the game, I think.
All right, Tannis, any questions?
No, it all sounds awful.
Okay. Fair enough.
All right. Shall we move on to the ambassador then?
Yeah. Yeah. Ambassador. All right.
So this is something that's been teased for a long time. So I think we can all
like 2 years.
Yeah. I think it goes back to RuneFest 17 probably. But
I think so too. Yeah.
Okay. So I'm just gonna say that David didn't get to experience this, but the graphics of this Elite Dungeon, he talked about the voice and the audio tracks to it. Those are great, but the graphics to it as well are absolutely amazing. So have a look at the YouTube channel, the video version of the show if you're listening to audio on this.
I think that it is a very popular opinion among people that the Ambassador in particular is the most beautifully designed graphical experience that they have ever created. I don't know if you feel that way, but a lot of people told me that that's how they feel about it.
I think if you factor everything in,
and certainly the most gorgeous TVM thing,
Elite Dungeon wise, then yeah, definitely. There was also one of the magic walls here that did catch us off guard, and we had to go back out because we
classic Elite Dungeon.
Classic Elite Dungeon magic walls preventing us from getting in. So, all right, the Ambassador, let's go.
Yeah, so quickly, solo is if you are a confident, experienced PVMer and have some money for desks and learning, solo Ambassador is one of the best PVM experiences they have ever created. I absolutely love it, and we'll be doing it. It is the reason I'm playing again, because I was kind of taking a break for a while playing a little old school. Ambassador has me fully back into RS3, and pleased that I purchased. The Trio experience is much, much more casual. It's totally manageable. And so there are some mechanics that can certainly kill you quite easily, but they're relatively avoidable. Basically, he attacks with ranged, and then there are these magic balls. I think that you had to deal with a couple of these, right?
Shane? Yeah,
They're like kind of like from 5K
Elite
or so,
kind of like from Elite Dungeon 1.
Yeah, exactly. So that's a really good place to catch a resonance because it always resonates for about 4 to 5K. The second is a very similar mechanic to, I can't even remember the boss's name, Shane, the very first boss in Elite Dungeon 1, where you get the bomb timer above your head.
Oh, what was it? Let me look that up. Continue on while I do that.
Yeah, so you get a timer above your head, and it creates kind of a cloud of gas that deals 2Ks, and so you want to kind of take that. You don't have to run it to the wall, but when you're first learning, I'd recommend running it all the way to the wall. Letting it explode over there and then
the Sanctum Guardian.
So that Sanctum Guardian bomb with the timer above your head. So you want to make sure that your teammates don't get hit by that, essentially, is what's important. And then there are these black holes that get spawned. And this is what killed me on my very first attempt because I didn't know how to deal with them. I thought it was some sort of like cruel joke because they each have 500k HP and a timer, and so we thought, like, how are we supposed to do 1.5 million damage in about 10 seconds? What's happening? And then you figure out that you just dismiss them by stunning them. So any stun ability will automatically get rid of them. And if you don't get rid of them, each one does 2 hits of damage that each hit 8,000. And so if you ignore all three, you get hit 6 times for 8K on the same game tick, even with Trin Masterwork, you can't survive. So definitely want to stun those to get rid of them. And then the next thing is It used to be skippable, and if you read my article, you could read about my thoughts about them removing the ability to skip this. But you get these artifacts get released, and this these walls of flames come out. Shane, maybe you could describe this a little bit, because on my graphic settings and with my lag, I can't quite see things very well.
All right. So what happens with this one is, directly in the center of the room, you have the ambassador. And with this, when this attack activates, the ambassador effectively puts out three big beams of light, starting off blue near him and moving out to purple near the end. And then they spin in a circle going clockwise. And you need to continually run, making sure that you don't get hit by that. Because if you do get hit by that, you're going to be dead.
Yeah, you can't. There's no way to survive.
Yeah, there's no way to survive.
At least, I'm sure in story mode you could. In the regular mode, it's just not happening. It's about 6.5k per tick that no one can out-eat that. And so there are these fragments, and the fragments have to be killed. And so you basically start in the northeast. We were starting south because that was what we knew on day of, you know, within a few hours of release. But now everyone starts northeast, and you just... if your team is struggling with the damage, you want to save abilities like Metamorphosis or Berserk here in order to improve your damage output. In solo, you could place Dominion Mines right next to the fragments, so that if the Dominion Mines will pop off and kill them, which I found interesting. And yeah, so you want to kill these, because for everyone that isn't destroyed, the ambassador will send out a bomb that hits everyone in the team for 8,000. And this is one where I barricade intercepted because we got three of them. And so I was not confident about your ability to out eat a 24K.
Hit. Yeah.
So
how would
24,000 damage. So
how would you out eat 24,000?
The way you do it is you disruption shield the first, resonance the second, out eat the third.
Okay. Yeah.
So that's how you do it technically. Okay. But I was
so
not,
that's how we survived that.
Yes, but I barricade intercept. So, but theoretically, you want to get zero. With enough practice, your team should be getting zero fragments or one fragment at most every single time. And the one fragment that you could either resonance the bomb, you could reflect the bomb, debilitate, any of those things work.
Now, did you notice also that Siryu came and joined the fight?
Oh, yeah. I can't see Siryu. I can only hear the audio. So I didn't know the thing until I turned the audio. Because I was just like, what are we getting healed by? What is killing all of these Crassians? But yeah, so once you get to phase two, these mechanics with the way the fire... the bombs, and then the black holes, and then the fire spin goes over and over and over until you phase it at 500k HP, and then a bunch of Crassian warriors spawn and deal ranged hits, which they're undamageable. But then Siryu comes in and heals us all. And so maybe you could talk about that too, since you could actually see what's happening.
Yeah, I was actually wondering what this was, and that, you know, if you look off to the side, you see this little blob, and hey, it's Siryu, and there's also these healing orbs happening on you. And, you know, that was an interesting surprise. I didn't have time to say anything when it was happening in the fight, but lo and behold, he was right there. So I noticed that, but I didn't get to do much on that. When we're actually
fighting.
Yeah,
and it was like the ambassador continues talking trash, and it's just like, Siryu, yeah, you've disappointed me. You could have been great, or something like that, right?
Yep.
The dialogue is really, really just expertly done, I thought.
Yeah, and you know, that's what I want to talk about next with this, is that, you know, you finish this, you kill the ambassador, and his final lines are, you think this is a victory? All you have done is bought yourself a few moments of respite. His arrival is inevitable, and you will not be able to save them.
Yeah. Yeah, I thought that was good, too.
You guys know what that's referring to, right?
It's Zautak, right?
Yeah, Zautak. And that's also what the Black Hands are referring to. You'll note that the Black Shadows and the Black Hands coming out of the floor in Elite Dungeon 1 were dangerous. And that's why when we were doing this, I had to ask, are the Hands here dangerous in Elite Dungeon 3? And no, they were not. So,
so the Hands actually alternate healing the boss. So the last 250,000 damage is erased is a DPS race, so it's can you out-damage the heals.
Okay, so and, it doesn't affect us, but it heals the boss.
Right, and so the way that the final phase works is in a trio, it's very easy, assuming you have high DPS output, to out-DPS the healing. It's no problem at all. It's 2.5k per tick. That's not an issue. And there's a healing beam that each hand, so each handout sends out white healing beams that look kind of like soul split heals.
Yep.
And so if you stand in front of the white soul split heals, they turn black because you're blocking the ambassador from being healed. And then that's when, after you do this three times, if you block three beams of healing in a row, and it keeps transferring, so it goes in a clockwise direction. So it'll go, one hand will heal it. If you block it for two or three abilities, the next hand clockwise will heal it, and it keeps going. And so the way you do solo is you have to go around and around in a circle so that you're always blocking the healing, because in a solo, there's no way to out DPS the healing.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And so after you block three beams of healing, the ambassador will say your name and then say something like time for you to fall. And that's when he switches from range to magic, and he does 4 8K magic hits. And so that's when you switch to magic prayer, use devotion in order to survive, or use reflect, debilitate, you know, whatever it is you need to do. And so that's sort of what the you fall mechanic is because you've blocked. And sometimes it can happen inadvertently in a trio where you just by RNG, you happen to block
right
his healing. If you kill the boss fast enough, you, are definitely for sure going to not get that mechanic. But if you kill a little bit slowly, then you can get that the sort of marked for death kind of thing. And so that's why solo, this is another reason why solo is such a different experience than trio, is because solo, that mechanic is highly deadly and has to be dealt with a lot of precision and precise movement and DPS at the right time, defenses at the right times. In a trio, with a reasonable amount of damage gear, you know, like tier 90 weapons, tier 80 armor type gear, you could very easily kill it faster than it heals, and it's no issue. So that's the ambassador fight, and I don't know. I mean, for me, in solo, it's in terms of mechanics and lore and all that, it's like a 10 out of 10. In terms of the rewards, I wrote aggressively long article about Elite Dungeon 3 that you could read probably in the next few days.
Yeah, it'll be up by the time the show's up at informer.rsbnb.com. So
yeah, I'm not a fan at all of the way they've balanced this particular dungeon in terms of rewards. I thought Elite Dungeon 1 post buff and Elite Dungeon 2 are extremely well balanced in terms of rewards. I think Elite Dungeon 3 is terribly balanced. But you know, that's kind of an opinion thing, and it's not super relevant. But the content itself is incredible, which is why I have a lot of hope, because it's easy to rebalance drop tables.
Yeah, and speaking of that, let's just have a quick listen to what the fight with the ambassador sounds like.
Sure.
And that's the ambassador. Pretty amazing. So, all right. Anything else on any of the mechanics before we move on? Talk a bit briefly about the rewards. No? Okay.
I don't think so. I mean, okay. I think the rewards is just a totally separate discussion. The crossbow is very, very cool. At current prices, things are going for about 900 mil per piece. So the crossbow is around, what is that?
2.7 billion.
I'm sure it'll go down a little bit. But basically the way the rewards work is like you make just enough to cover your supplies with a chance of a huge money item. That's incredibly rare. And that's not my favorite that's not necessarily my favorite way of balancing drop mechanics, but it is a consistent trend. So Solak and this are both low GP per hour, but very high value rare drop. My concern is just if the crossbow ever normalizes to a reasonable amount, then it's just going to be only worth it for the pet. And you could say, like, do it for the fun of the fight, and I get that. But at a certain point, you know, Telos is fun too. I don't know.
Okay. The crossbow does have a really interesting special attack from reading this. For 15 seconds when you use the split soul special attack, instead of healing the player, your soul split curse damages your target for 4 times the amount of life points it would have normally healed. I think that's pretty good. Do you see this crossbow being usable or being something that people will outright go and seek out?
Yeah, I mean, Andy, Base Tank, bought the crossbow in order to break his own Nex record, because there's, like, parts of Nex where you soul split, and he's pretty convinced that he'll be able to break his record quite easily with the new crossbow. I think that phase five of normal mode, phase 10 and 11 of hard mode, Virago, the crossbow is going to be absolutely sick because you're soul splitting the whole time. So yeah, I think it's like really, really good. I don't think it's 3-bill good though.
All right. Tier 92 Blackstone arrows as well. Craftable with this from Blackstone arrowheads that you get as drops. Also right. New sigils, Dragon Slayer, Demon Slayer, and Undead sigils increase damage by 15% for 10 seconds, to these kind of creatures. Requires 50 Blackstone hearts, which you get from this elite dungeon, 1 onyx to make them, and you get 1,000 charges and can be recharged with onyx dust at a rate of 2 charge per dust. So,
yeah, and I think the arrows are also really fantastic,
yeah,
for a lot of reasons. Yeah. And I heard that they don't work with Seren Godbow as of now, but that is going to be fixed. But once they work with the Seren Godbow, that'll be a very nice boost to that weapon.
Yeah, they reduce the armor rating of your target. Each hit reduces the armor by 0.75% to a maximum of 22.7 armor capping after 20 hits. So
my only issue, and it's minor, the direction of bosses, so the last couple elite dungeons plus Solak, has been to give players with decent gear 100% accuracy. So that particular thing is only useful for content that's several years old. So things like Virago, Telos, or Nex, which have incredibly high armor ratings. Things like Solak, that perk is like literally wasted. It's totally useless because you're already 100% accuracy. I think that it's an interesting choice, but it's a little weird to me that they're giving, you know, that one of the selling points of new content is something that helps you with content that they've totally moved away from in terms of the, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. All right. I think we can move on to some of the QOL changes this week that came with this update, in particular the spotlight system. Each elite dungeon will be spotlighted on a different day, offering a trio of bonuses to players, including plus 25% dungeoneering XP, an extra mini boss, and minus 20% death reclaim costs. They're also buffing loot again in the Temple of Amanishi. Have you gone back since then?
No, but I do know someone has, and they say that efficient soloing is about 40 mil an hour. Which is better, which is what? As good as Solak.
What?
Yeah.
What?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Is that okay, Tanis? Is that okay?
I mean, and this is for like,
the five people that can do it, yeah, it's wonderful.
If you're like,
right?
very good, you know, getting consistent fast kills, no deaths, no banking, you know, etc. But yeah, I've heard it's 40 mil an hour plus on average now.
So we have a problem with Telos. Let's make another problem. Sounds great.
The thing is that if enough people start doing that, the tier 92 ranged armor is so niche and most people only use it in places where it doesn't drain that prices will crash so fast and it'll be back to like 15. I'm sure it'll be 15 mil an hour again in 2 months.
Okay. All right. So something we ought to watch out for then. We'll keep up on that. Boss.
And also, I haven't confirmed that, by the way.
All right.
So take what we just said there
in a grain of salt then. Yes. Incoming boss timers for the elite dungeons to track your performance as you can with all the other bosses that we have in game so far. And they also added two new boss pets, Ambi and Bizdi, as well. So, all right. Moving on to the patch notes right now. Not too many this week in terms of general fixes. Everything has been focused on ED3 and Curse of the Blackstone. So, just run through a few of these. The Botanist Mask add-on has been re-added to the Flash Powder Factory rewards interface. That's good because, you know, you need to have a place in-game where you can get these items that were exclusively Treasure Hunter. And, of course, the Botanist Mask is for Herblore. So good move on this one. Premier chests have been removed from the Grand Exchange, so if you still haven't claimed your rewards from the 2018 Premier Club, you can talk to the Vault Guardian to claim them, and of course this included things like the tokens for the mining and smithing rework, and the quest point shop, and so on and so forth. You can now also convert clue scrolls via the downgrade option beyond the soft cap of 25 per tier. This was a hot fix from the previous week. If you don't like doing master clues or you don't like doing elite clues, you can take them down. Also corrected a case where the coin of the realm quest was flagged as a replayable quest, and therefore its one-time rewards were given out on replays. All right. Not exactly sure. I don't remember what exactly coin of the realm was, but it's interesting nonetheless. I'm sure someone...
I vaguely remember this.
Someone in Clan Quest will correct me on this. So, let's see. This was the initial subquest of Dimension of Disaster. Okay, so it makes sense why that one shouldn't be replayable. All right. Was not flagged as a replayable quest. Okay. The headings in the combat difficulty quest sword interface have been changed from combat level to NPC combat level to clarify that the quests are sorted by NPC combat level rather than suggested player level. And I think this was something confusing when this list came out. So this is, of course, sorting the quest by the maximum combat level that you will see in that quest. The festive snow inside the developer's console has been disabled. I don't know how many players use the developer's console regularly, but I didn't even notice the snow was there.
That's so funny.
Yeah,
I only use it for FPS.
Yeah, you press Alt-Tilde to activate it, if anyone's wondering what we're talking about, and that's the button next to the one key on your keyboard. Then a bunch of various crash fixes in the client, such as when recycling resources or where items on the floor could not be interacted with. Sometimes that has been fixed. They also fixed a crash in Elite Dungeon 1, or actually all the Elite Dungeons, when using the Java client. And finally, resizing your game window may cause client errors. Please resize your game window on the login screen to avoid this issue, they say. So that's it. That's it for the patch notes this week. Not too much to write home about there, I don't think. So... All right. Anything else in the patch notes before we move on to some other little RS related things?
I didn't pay much attention to the patch notes. I was just kind of
Everything was ED3.
Kind of locked in on ED3.
Yeah. The coin of the realm one though is interesting, with it not being flagged as replayable, and therefore it's one time rewards were given on replays. So. I'd be interested to know stat-wise how many people have actually gone back to redo Dimension of Disaster and its subquests.
I know I think a fair amount of people have the Chromatic Party Hat, right?
Yeah, the Rainbow Party Hat that changes colors.
I had to do it for the Comp Cape requirement.
Okay.
So anyone with the Comp Cape has done that stuff.
All right. Fair enough. You guys ready to move on to some other RuneScape related news? This first one actually coming from Jagex themselves for Android users. Very, very interesting news on the RuneScape mobile front. They're increasing the beta cap on March 5th and March 6th, bringing in another 50,000 slots.
Oh, wow. That's
yeah, and you know, this is basically going to give anybody who wants access to it access, I feel. Because if you look at the number of people playing RS3, it averages between 20 and 25,000 per day. It did spike up to around 35,000 to 40,000 on Double XP weekend. And even with that, the people who are going to be paying attention to this announcement are the ones who are playing. And as we've talked about before, when you chunk updates in, when you combine them with coming off a Double XP weekend, as we had here with ED3 and Curse of the Blackstone, and then this announcement later on in the week that they were going to be increasing the cap for the Android beta, this it tells us that this is something that they want the community to latch onto and talk about. So my hunch is that this is going to be the final cap increase, assuming things go well before we head on into an open beta for RS3, which, as we said, would put us at the tail end of Q1 or early mid to early Q2 of 2019, I think, for this.
Cool. I just hope that on the release of it to the iTunes store, they have a filter for the what I assume will be a massive amount of OSRS trolling of the RS3 comment section. I'm a little worried that it's going to get one star reviews by the thousands.
The issue with these app stores is that you really can't go in and pick and choose and delete reviews. So
I know that's frustrating, but yeah. It's going to happen. And I don't know. It would just be really sad if it had like two stars or something for no other reason. Than
yeah.
Just,
well,
like,
I mean, that's going to be
coordinated trolling.
That's going to be a reason for everybody who wants to get in on this beta to do it and make sure that you give the app a review on your respective app store when it arrives. So,
yep.
Final piece of RuneScape news, not coming from Jagex this week. Jagex has hired 4 high-profile game industry residents to work on various products inside Jagex. And in particular, first and foremost, they have hired the guy from CCP, Ubisoft Montreal, and Trion Worlds, who is, of course, veteran Nathan Richardson. And he has been brought on board to work on the unannounced MMO that is going to be using the Unreal 4 engine at Jagex. He says that our primary focus will be setting up a strong leadership team and ensure we get those key hires in place, such as a product director and senior product marketing manager. This project demands high-definition work, and I am already impressed with the passion, talent, and commitment of the current team. And combine this with the strength of our plans for the new game, I am confident that we will have a very successful future. Now, this comes on the heels earlier of Jagex hiring SVP of development, Nick Beliaf, and he also commented on this, welcoming Nathan Richardson to the team on this. And you would think that this would be the only hire that would be announced this week, but they have also hired Pete McKay, who was appointed as Director of Community, having held similar roles at CCP and Riot Games. And also they hired Agatha Bajan, formerly of EA, Microsoft, and Natural Motion, who has been brought on board as Head of CRM, Community Relations Management, and Player Engagement. And they also have a new technical director for RuneScape, for its flagship MMO RuneScape, the article says, who is Mitchell Godwin, who is a 20-year veteran of the game development sector, who has worked as an engine programmer at Codemasters, and he moved later on to the role of programming lead and head of development at Sony London. And the final hire is Alan Krauss, who's been hired as a senior director of game engineering and previously worked at Sony Online Entertainment, Trion Worlds, and Amazon. Okay. So what does this mean for unannounced MMO, you guys?
Means I'm excited.
as these are some pretty, pretty big hires. Because if you look at the direction that RuneScape went, RuneScape grew internally, of course. They had brought key people in the past. But these are top-end game industry experts.
Yeah, and well, and like the guy from the Montreal Ubisoft, I know they've done really good work in the past. So I'm excited about that.
You guys have any further ideas of what this unannounced MMO could be based on these hires?
Yeah, I'm not sure exactly. I haven't followed it too much.
Okay.
I still think it's a ESO like RuneScape theme type of game.
Do you think it'll be multi-platform? I mean, beyond just mobile, but like
I think
like,
you need to do that at this point in the game. And given the fact it's on Unreal Engine 4, you can port that easily to the Xbox and PS4 and mobile, which we know the big bottleneck for mobile has been, of course, getting the engine going. And now they're in the phase where they're tailoring the UI.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, I'm interested in it potentially. I don't know. I hope – my only hope is that it does not result in more people leaving RS3.
Yeah.
Like this week – this week's felt awesome. A lot of my friends who I haven't seen in months, including myself actually, are playing the game again because of ED3. But it's like it's been a rough 18 months of watching people either switch to old school or leave. So I'm just, you know, I just don't want there to be more divisions, although that's totally selfish and not relevant.
Well,
to
no, it's profits, actually a very relevant point because, you know, we currently have old school and we have RuneScape 3. And I go back to the presentation at RuneFest where they did the night before, where it was uniting the RuneScape community to solve a RuneScape quest. And I think any new game that they bring out has to bring the communities together. If people are going to be interested in the game.
Yeah, it's got to.
I mean, this, I actually think we're probably pretty good in that regard, just because RuneScape is such a, it's just different in the way that you play it. There's nothing that would be on an Unreal Engine 4 that would be anything like what we play. So I don't think it's going to cannibalize the player base, really. Because people that like this style, they like this style. I mean, they might go to old school, because that's the cool thing to do. But I can't see someone switching from RuneScape if they genuinely like RuneScape to another completely different style of game.
Exactly.
That's just not going to happen. It might actually bring people into ours because they're like, oh, this is a little more laid back. I can play this while I'm actually playing this action, awesome adventure, just goodness, you know?
Like, yeah.
That could happen.
Yeah. And you notice they're not calling it unannounced MMO, whereas if you look at the Jagex careers page, it does say unannounced MMO. There could be multiple projects at work. They could both be using Unreal 4. This could be in relation to something else. We, of course, don't know. And, you know, I think it would not be good to talk about that kind of speculation on the podcast like this. But, you know, I think the only thing we can see is that if they wanted to do something on the Unreal 4 engine, like you said, Tanis, it would have to be almost kind of like ESO, but in the same way, maybe more closer to Diablo, I think, in that it would be more combat-oriented.
Right, okay. Yeah, that's fair.
So I want to kind of refrain from speculation on this because I don't want to be creating any potential fires in the community. Reddit does that well enough. So
yes, they do.
All right. So we do have a listener discussion topic regarding this quest. So before we do that, I'll just take a moment to thank our wonderful Patreon supporters. And this week we would like to thank Ben W, Brock H, Kyle, and Zez. Thank you guys for your wonderful support of RSBNB Update and believing what we do. And of course, everybody else who supports us on Patreon as well. And if you want to learn more about that, you can head on over to patreon.com/ RSBNB, and you can sign up for one of the tiers that we offer. So for $1 a month, you will receive a special mention in our show notes and gain early access to those show notes, as well as the ability to join our roundtable discussions when we do them, and you'll help fund RSBNB for the cost of hosting and production. And for $3 a month, you'll receive a special VIP rank in Discord and a special mention on the podcast at the start of the month, as well as high-quality stereo AAC versions of the show. And for $5 a month, you'll receive a shout-out on the podcast each and every week and gain exclusive access to the outtakes that we use for the clip show at the end of the year. And what we're doing with this, we're doing our monthly bit bonus show, and these are focused around one or two things within the RuneScape community. This month's was on money making with skilling. I know that sounds like an oxymoron, but we got it done, and it was actually surprising the amount of time we were able to spend on that, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was surprising the amount of techniques that I didn't even realize, and I thought I was quite the skiller. So, yeah.
So if you want to hear these, patreon.com/RSBNB. You can gain access to those for as little as $1 a month. If we reach $30 a month, we'll be doing Inside RSBNB Update, which includes interviews and a look inside our host and production. $50 a month will be our roundtable on the first Saturday of each and every month. And if we reach $99 a month, for some absurd reason, we'll be doing movie night in the RSBNB Discord, which can probably include some Star Trek and maybe some Star Wars for other people. So...
so generous.
I'm giving that concession. All of this and more can be found at patreon.com/RSBNB. And thank you once again to Ben W., Brock H., Kyle, and Zez. Your support means the world to us.
Thanks, guys.
Okay, so we got a discussion topic here from Tycho regarding Curse of the Blackstone. He says, "Dear RSBNB, this week we saw the release of Curse of the Blackstone, a surprise quest which took us through all the elite dungeons and added a ton of lore which previously had only been available from lore streams and theories by lore fanatics. For me, lore is a very important part of the game that makes the experience more emotional and realistic, but what are your opinions on lore in RuneScape? Now, continuing on with this, the quest also introduced several points to the game which should not be brushed aside, being the first official quest that introduces the Ark and takes you on a grand tour, taking advantage of story mode in a way that doesn't block adventurers from completing it, the story and maybe the beginning of a post-endgame storyline, several lore theories coming to light, such as Hannibus being Vindicta's father, and plot twists like Madame Xi being a double agent all this time. My question here is, what was your favorite part of the quest and why? And to sum it up, the twists from when this went from an introduction quest to the elite dungeons to a post-endgame dragon quest to a save-the-world quest almost made me explode. Mod Raven, who was online at the time of the release and guested in the lore friends chat, laughed as we flipped out over the content. Humor and deep lore, two ingredients with an evil laugh behind it, but if a new quest is about to be made, what is one thing it must have for you? It can be, example, a good story, a boss mechanics we've never seen before, or rewards you would have never dreamed of. I hope you have a good time and am waiting to hear your answers on this. I would have personally loved to have been on this podcast, and to be honest, I nagged like an old grandma to be here, but not all wishes can come true. I wish you all sunshine, and may the RNG be with you. Tycho, Elf of the Nordic Lands." Lore in RuneScape, number one.
That's a lot of questions.
Yeah, it is.
The lore is really fun. I really wish they released a quest with every single boss. Like, I think it'd be so fun if the release of Solak came with a Solak origin quest.
Oh, that would have been great.
I really, really want there to be origin quests for stuff like Araxor and Virago, because how did Araxor get there? It's all of a sudden, it's just there. It went from not there to there. I think stuff like that. I think that for me, even as someone who only PVMs and does basically nothing else, I mean, I skilled in order to get a completionist cape because it's the best in slot cape, item or whatever for PVM, but that's what I do, but questing is my second favorite, and I really think that Elite Dungeon 3 made me realize how much more fun we could get out of PVM if there was a significant lore element to it as well.
Yeah, I'm going to agree. And, you know, in regards to lore in RS, I think it's got perhaps one of the deepest lores I've ever seen in any games that are out there.
Do you have 20 years of it at this point?
Exactly. And, you know, there are people who, you know, can't even recount it in the entire community. And we've done our best here on the podcast before providing summaries of the ages and whatnot. There are, of course, other things that could be done on this, but it is huge. And I think that, you know, people look at RuneScape and they see something simple on the surface, but once you dive down, it's so deep, the lore with it. So I wouldn't trade it in for anything else, personally. I absolutely love it. How about you, Tanis?
Well, I mean, lore is just another word, you know, for story, and story is essential in any game for me. I'm not so much into the mindless kind of fun type of stuff. I like story. Now that, you know, there can be challenges with that because, you know, the reading stuff isn't quite as fun. But I really got into lore when I started. I mean, of course, when I started questing, but when I started questing, I'm like, okay, there's no way I'm ever going to be able to, like, keep up with this or catch up with this. So I actually started watching some videos on YouTube of people that, like, kind of told the story, the lore narratively, and that was the best thing I ever did. That it just sold me on it, and it made everything make sense. Whereas, you know, it's kind of hard when you're grabbing the little pieces and little passages out of this book or this lore drop, and it was just a way to, like, put it all together. And when you put it all together, it's really well written. Like, it's really well done. It's not disjointed like you kind of feel like it is as you're playing. When you, like, step back and take a look at it, it's really good. And
it's like, wow.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
And for the second question, for me, I think a great quest has one of two things. A good quest has one of two things. A great quest has both. And so for me, that's a significant piece of lore that I wouldn't have expected, and a reward that isn't necessarily great, but is a reward that I will interact with on a consistent basis. Use on whether that's an item or, you know, this 10% reduction of damage thing, or, you know, whatever it is, just like an item that, or an ability, you know, whatever it is that I will consistently utilize and not, you know, forget about.
You know, I think you summarized that very well for that point. And for that one, I have to point back to the fairy quests in regards to the magic secateurs. It was, you know, great fairy lore, but also something that farmers use all the time. And magic watering can too. So that's a perfect example. That's a perfect example of it. You know, you can have watering quests about humor and whatnot, but the best ones do seem to be defined by exactly what you said. So I'm going to go with you on that one as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Watering can is a perfect example for sure. It's like, it's not game changing at all, but it is game changing in terms of convenience, and you interact with it constantly. So I really like that.
How about you, Tanis?
I totally agree.
Okay.
Yeah. No, easy, I mean, I really do.
I guess it wasn't a very hot take.
Well, I mean, no, and I mean, I know I'm going to probably catch some hell for this, but, like, I need a decent reward in a quest, or I don't feel like, I don't know, I need that. Not that it's not worth it. The story in of itself is worth it, but I want something cool. That's just a kid in me. I want something good that I'm going to use, just like you said, David.
All right.
Yeah. For sure.
And favorite part of the quest, I think it had to be the part where the ambassador appeared in Goshima with Madame Shi and killed everyone.
Me too.
Of course it was.
It got me so hyped for Elite Dungeon 3. I was like, as soon as that happened, I was like, I wish I could put this on pause and just go immediately into the dungeon. But of course I'm... You know, I take my comp kit very seriously. So I refuse to PV. No, all PVMers are like this who have comp that no one PVMs until they get their comp kit back. It's like, don't do it. So,
well, hopefully that'll be fixed with the comp kit rework.
Broken.
Oh, yeah, sure. I mean, I don't know. I personally don't mind it at all. I enjoy logging in and seeing if I can't wear it because it means there's a new thing for me to do. But.
And the reason that this was the best moment, I think, was because it summed up everything that Elite Dungeon 1 and Elite Dungeon 2 have ultimately been leading up to. And I don't know if this quest was involved or the idea to do this quest was there since Elite Dungeon 1, but they kept this remarkably well hidden. And I have to really commend them on that. I'd like to see more updates like this that are kind of hidden updates like this that just get plopped in and away we go. On this, and it just improved the experience, and it just made it all three Elite Dungeons feel as though that they were actually part of the lore and part of the synergy of the game.
So, yeah, I would say this may sound controversial, but I would say I wish that the majority of the content was like this.
Yeah,
hidden, update, fresh on release. It's just the communication stuff was great until Reddit became, you know, a hegemon of toxicity.
Yeah.
And then it kind of ruined it. So I kind of, post Reddit, I just think that I want to return to what it used to be. Like secret updates. I think that's the best way to do it.
Alrighty. Thank you, Tycho, for that one. If you guys want to send your own questions in, you can email them to questions@rsbnb.com, or you can leave us a DM on Twitter @RSBNB. All right, so we only got two tech news stories this week. I was going to put in three, but I thought, we can kind of have the gaming vets joining Jagex be one of our tech news stories. So we only have two tech news stories that are separate to this. And the one we got this week, headline reads as follows: Facebook says it will finally launch long-awaited clear history feature this year, and it could hurt ad targeting. So this is a clear history feature that was announced in 2018 and will severely impact Facebook's ability to target ads. So what this means is that the feature will effectively allow users to see information about the apps and websites that they've interacted with and delete this information from their Facebook accounts. And yeah, of course Facebook is gonna hurt from this because that's their bread and butter of how they make money. And you know, we've seen similar provisions come into place in the EU, the right to be forgotten, where websites, big websites, have to offer an ability to delete your account and receive all your information out from it. And it's about time that Facebook does this, given that it was almost 1 year ago in May at the F8 conference that Mark Zuckerberg himself made the announcement where he said it would be a simple way to control and to clear your browsing history on Facebook, what you've clicked on, what websites you've visited, and so on. They need to do this, and quite frankly, I think for anybody who uses Facebook, it's going to be terrifying to see what happens when you can see all this data they have on you. So, coming soon.
I'm so skeptical of all things Zuck, and thoroughly anti-Zuck. But you know, I don't know too much about this stuff either.
I'll believe it when I see it. I hope so.
Yeah, and you know, I think if you could, like, with this would alleviate a certain number of the fears that people have about using Facebook, right?
I don't know. You know, every day there's another story that just makes me more fearful. So I don't know.
I also feel like it ultimately doesn't matter that much because so many of us, I know me for sure, like, I have to have it for my job. Like, it's totally vital. I don't know what an alternative would be in terms of just mass communication platforms. I guess other social medias, but I don't know how that fixes it.
We had these novel things about 15 to 20 years ago called message boards.
I wish I knew what that was. I'm serious. Do you think I'm joking? I'm totally serious.
Really?
I have no clue what that,
okay.
I know what that is. I don't really mean that.
Like to give you an example of this, you know, in the early 2000s, there was a push
to
get.
So when I was seven.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay.
early 2000s, mid 2000s, when you were when you were 12, probably.
Okay.
If you'd sign up for a university class, you would often have a message board associated with that, where, and that's how you'd communicate with the students and the teachers and whatnot.
Oh, My school had that my freshman year, right. And it was the last year of it. They totally got rid of it. It doesn't exist anymore. We had this message board called Blackboard.
Yep, that's what it was.
Yeah, everyone has Blackboard. Yeah.
So the University of Texas, which is where I went to undergrad, my freshman year was the final year that they used that, and then they phased it out, and it doesn't exist, at least as far as UT is concerned.
And see, so, I mean, you might as well
all the professors just use Facebook groups.
You might as well just use Facebook groups, right? So
yeah. So I suppose I do know what that is. So as a sophomore in college, I never interacted with a message board. And honestly, none of us used – the professors never used Blackboard because I remember one of my teachers saying – we're supposed to use Blackboard, but I know none of you understand that, so I just made a Facebook group for class.
Yeah.
So that's what we did.
So, I mean, there were times where it wasn't used, but everybody's using it now. So.
Yeah.
All right. So we'll see if that arrives. We're coming up on 1 year since it was first announced, so fingers crossed that it does. Our next piece of tech news, Android is now FIDO 2 certified. So what does this mean? This is actually one thing that is good for Android users that iOS currently doesn't have. So what this means is that mobile apps and websites can utilize this standard now to ultimately provide a simpler way for users of Android devices supporting Android 7 Plus to log in. Now, this is... going to be completely automated, or after Google Play services updates a specific device, you will effectively be able to use your fingerprint sensor and or FIDO security keys to have secure passwordless access to websites and native apps that decide to support this open protocol. And this is something that Android is doing, and if you have a Google phone or if you have a Samsung phone, regardless of what kind of Android it is, it will work. And it's already supported in the market by web browsers such as Chrome, Edge, and Firefox, and preview support by even Safari with this. So this is comprised of a number of specifications from the World Wide Web Consortium, who effectively build standards for websites to ensure that if you build a website, it'll work on Chrome, it'll work on Firefox, it'll work on Safari. And when you combine all of these standards together, it enables users to securely log into online services if they are FIDO 2 compliant. And these can be built directly into the Android smartphone, or they can be through external fingerprint readers or cameras or even standalone security keys. So this is an attempt by this group, the FIDO Alliance, to build a global ubiquitous authentication mechanism that will work for practically every device. It's just up to the various standards providers out there, namely Google and Apple, to support it. We know Apple won't because they like to have their own way. But if you have an Android device, there's a good chance in the coming years you will be able to adopt this for your devices. And if you use Chrome on your Android phone, you will effectively have free two-factor authentication, both the password and your biometric data through your fingerprint reader or your face scanner, depending on what kind of device you have. And what this brings for many websites that do ultimately choose to support this is just a way to create another way of securing their website or service so that people don't need to go out there and get a third-party authentication tool, and they can just make sure that the difficulty of someone getting hacked goes from just being able to get their password to being able to actually have to compromise this protocol. So this is a pretty big deal for Android in particular.
Okay. Do you think that there's going to be a change due to this in terms of the Android versus Apple market?
No, you know, I think that when it comes around to this, you know, people are going to stick within their own devices and their own ecosystems because, you know, I already have my one password on my iOS device, whereas if people are on Android, they're going to be able to supplement whatever they're doing with this. So, you know, as nice as it would be to get Touch ID on the Apple side, to support this. I don't know, or I don't see Apple doing something like this, but it's an open standard, and Apple has supported open standards in the past. So I guess there will be some question at some point whether or not Apple will decide to. So this is good news for the internet, nonetheless.
And yeah, good I news feel like I'm an iOS user password. Purely because that was the first smartphone I happened to purchase, and I'm just used to it.
Yeah.
You know, like I just feel like I like it because I'm accustomed. But if you asked me why is this better than that, I couldn't tell you at all. I would just say I'm used to it.
Yeah, so I agree.
I have no clue if which one is better or what I should be using. So,
all right, Tanis, you have any questions or any ideas on that? I mean, it's security and
yeah.
We don't
I mean,
know
it's
how hard magic passwords can be.
Exactly. No, I think it's great for the Android users out there. I don't ever see myself being one of them, but you know, it's good. Security is important.
Indeed it is. Well, we're going to move on to some other things, and we are actually going to go through everybody's achievements for Double XP weekend, because I feel that, you know, this is a big week and might as well make it a big RSVP update. So we're just going to dive right into that right now, the Double XP weekend batch of achievements. So here we go, starting off on February 27th, Oza Zoyo got 120 invention. Also on that day, Tuwa got 120 invention as well. Chaz 5100 with 99 range on February 26th. Now moving on to the 25th of February, we have Love Natural with 99 smithing, Jaguar 007 with 99 agility, Blind Man 0122 with 99 attack, Patapolo with 99 hunter, Rolladude 540 with 99 hunter as well on the 25th, Blind Man again with 99 strength, Darth Angel, or Darth Marth with 99 Dungeoneering, Karen Angel with 120 Dungeoneering, Jaguar 007 with 99 Thieving, and moving on to the 24th, we had Anex Demarius with 99 Fletching, Nanya Business 9 with 99 Mining, also on the 24th, Love Natural again with 99 Mining, Blind Man 0122 with 99 Prayer, Dirpalt New with 99 Hunter, Amberlay with 120 thieving, sorry. Merlvec with 99 thieving. Matt 258 with 120 fishing. KJTH Howard with 120 crafting. Mr. Jingles with 200 million smithing experience. NX Demarius with 99 fishing on the 24th. Ferox Kratos with 99 herblore on the 24th. Duke Juker with 99 attack on the 24th, Moodragon X with 99 smithing on the 24th, The Quiver with 99 prayer also on the 24th, Sangrasani with 120 invention, Easel with 120 dungeoneering, Tanbino with 99 prayer, Blind Man 0122 with 99 herblore, 99 fletching, 99 divination also on the 24th, Duke Juker with 99 strength, Jammo with 99 crafting, The Quiver with 99 herblore, Dirpalt New with 99 fletching, Frar also with 99 fletching on the 23rd, Zerko 602 continuing on the 23rd with 99 magic, Murovic with 99 construction, Questscaping with 99 invention, and Love Natural with 99 summoning.
All right, so to continue, we have our very own Shane 12088 with 120 herblore on the 23rd, Cave Woman with 120 crafting, Jamandi 52 with 200 mil herblore, Snow Trader with 120 defense, Nordic Falcon with 99 summoning, Chaz 5100 with 99 summoning, Farrar with 99 construction, Derpelt New 99 crafting, Jamandi 52 120 slayer, Rolladude 540 99 fletching, Love Natural 99 prayer, Duke Juker 99 construction, Anex Tiamaris 99 crafting, Curtains 99 herblore, Dirpalt New 99 construction, J1 J2 J3 with 120 invention, Cool Banksy with 99 construction, Dirpalt New 99 agility,
Cool Banksy, 99 agility as well. Quest Caping, 99 Slayer. Halal Bacon, 120 invention. sure. Love Natural, 99 defense. Roll a Dude, 540, 99 crafting. Sack Spieler, 99 mining. Snow Trader, 120 Slayer. Wolfeltopia, 99 defense. Zerker, 602, 99 constitution. Ferox Kratos, 99 summoning. Jamandi, 52, 120 summoning. Barrage Tank, 120 ranged. Cubond, 008, 99 herb. Hockey's Fuego, 99 engineering. Ferrar, 99 invention. Mood Dragon X, 99 summoning. Corrupt Pony, 99 summoning. Wolfeltopia, 99 crafting. Nordic Falcon, 99 attack. Ishk, 120 slayer. And I just was stopping that, right? Yes. Or Frox Kratos, 99 invention. Hockey's Fuegos, 99 hunter. The Quiver, 99 summoning. Frar, 99 Herblore. Cool Banksy, 99 invention. Chaz, 5100, 99 smithing. Dirpalt Noon, 99 summoning. Love Natural, 99 range. Mood Dragon X, 99 Herblore. Love Natural, 99 Herblore. Truly a Weave, 99 strength. Blind Man, 0122, 99 slayer. And Truly a Weave with 99 prayer.
Thanks, David, for powering through all those. That was about 20 more than you were supposed to do, but that's
yeah,
a okay.
I'm sorry. I totally forgot where I was supposed to stop.
That's okay. That's okay.
I appreciate it. Thanks for the solid there, bud.
Yeah, well,
Good work, everybody, on all those achievements. Definitely something to see on Double XP Weekend. And I think this is going to be a new tradition, reading them out, no matter how long the list is.
Yeah, it was great to see some of the names from way back, man. I don't know the last time I've seen some of them names on there.
Yeah, and you know that's what it is. Double XP Weekend always brings people out and brings them around, and they keep playing RS, and they come back, they listen to the show, and get a few achievements along the way. And it's always nice to see people returning to the game. So good job, everyone. Good job.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so I'm going to grace everybody with a pick of the week. I think this is only my second pick of the week in 2019, which is really odd when you think about it. But this is something that I took up the offer on back in November, and it arrived at the tail end of January. And you guys will know that I've talked for a long time about playing Star Trek Online, and you know, if you talk it to the developers of Star Trek Online and you look at their online infographics and media, you'll see that there are potentially over 500 starships in Star Trek Online, both from actually within the TV series and designs that were designed specifically for Star Trek Online. And there is this unique company out of Silicon Valley area of California called Gameprint, and what they do is they allow you to take your starship from Star Trek Online and have it 3D printed. Yes, you can take your very own starship that you have designed from within that game and have it 3D printed, and with that you get shipped what effectively amounts to a collectible of a design that, you know, is something that you see on your computer screen and you can use as a prop on your own shelf, or if you have your own Star Trek shelf, for example, as I do, you can have it there and you can have that as a real life tie-in to something that you have in game. So the way this works is that when you're in game, assuming you have a Star Trek Online account, you just go to any ship tailor and you choose the 3D print the ship option, and it will upload it to gameprint.net. And what happens with that is that when it gets uploaded, it takes the exact model as you have it in game, and then Gameprint will create a 3D replica of that starship. They come in 4, 5, 7, and 9-inch designs. And, you know, 3D printing is an inherently expensive thing to do. When they first started off offering this last spring, it was around $300 US to get a 12-inch model printed. But since then, the process has been refined, and it goes as low as $20 for a 4-inch of your starship, and all the way up to around $150 for the 9-inch model of your starship. And, you know, this is something I think that anybody who plays this game, anybody who has played any kind of MMO before, you'll know that when it comes to something that you use in game, whether it be, you know, your RuneScape character in the game of Star Trek Online, your ship, it's definitely a fun thing to have. And, you know, it just adds that extra little dimension of having something special from the game. So I went ahead and got one of the ships that I've been using since 2012 3D printed, and it just came out absolutely immaculately. And I'll put some pictures of it in the show notes just to show the level of detail on this thing. But it's something that has improved game immersion, and, you know, tying it over to RuneScape, it would be nice to see 3D printing of something RuneScape related by a company like GamePrint at some point in the future. I don't know how that would go with Jagex being a UK company, but when it comes down to it at the end of the day, wouldn't it be nice if we could get, say, a 3D printed character model after they update at some point in the future, the character model densities, or even a 3D printed Tower of Voices?
I want a 3D printed ambassador.
Yeah. Oh yeah. There you go. That would be something.
Yeah.
I know at RuneFest they had wood sculpted figurines of Solak, which is of course different than 3D printing, but still you can kind of get the idea behind it. So if there are any of you guys out there listening who also do happen to play Star Trek Online, this is something you can look into. But, you know, even if you don't play Star Trek Online, I just wanted to showcase this because it is a really neat thing that they're doing, and I'm not sure specifically of any other games that do anything like this. And when it comes to Star Trek and collectibles, that's something that cannot be underestimated. So that's the pick of the week, GamePrint for Star Trek Online.
Very cool.
Yeah, and I'll post pictures in the show notes to get an idea of the detail on this, but it looks really, really good. All right, so what have we been up to? What have you been up to this week, Tannis? What did you get up to on Double XP weekend?
Not much, man. I really didn't. I got pretty sick that weekend. But, you know, managed to do a little bit of Slayer, and this week I brought back the junior account to start doing some player owned farm.
Oh, good. I like the player owned farm.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. David, I don't know that I necessarily need to ask because I know it's going to be Elite Dungeon 3 and the quest. So unless there's anything else you want to share, go for it.
No, that's kind of what I've been doing this week. I've just been doing a lot of investor. So,
yeah. Okay. All right. Sounds good. As for me, Double XP weekend, got 120 Herblore, did a bunch of invention as well, with 5,200 protein cogs, and got all the way up to level 109 invention. 5,200 of those things I had stacked up.
Wow.
Yeah.
So.
Well, one thing I'll say is I've been doing attempts at, so No Food Ambassadors are already been done. I've been doing attempts at No Food solo for the entire dungeon from start to finish. And on my most recent attempt, I got Ambassador down to 30k HP and then just made a silly mistake and got one-shotted by something. But I think I'm going to be able to get a No Food full ED3 at some point.
Nice. Nice. Yeah. But after that, I've just been mining a bit because I have not made a set of Masterwork yet, and I think that's up next for me. So
there you go.
But I believe that's it for this episode, unless there's anything else you guys want to mention.
I think that's it. Thanks. Yeah. Thanks for having me on.
All righty. Was fun. Definitely fun doing Elite Dungeon 3 with you and the subsequent quest. And like I said, it's been a long time since we had anything like that. So a monumental RSBNB update nonetheless. So with that being said, we'll see you guys next week for the first update of March. And if you want to join us in-game, you can find us at Friends Chat Bits Bytes, or you can follow us on Twitter at RSBNB. And we'll see you next week, everyone. Take care.
See ya.